That
it's
is a
absolutely
thing.
A thing.
It's a thing.
It's the tunnel through the English Channel. It's the channel. Google channel. The channel tunnel, French Le Tunnel sous la Manche, also nicknamed and shortened to channel.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. With me in the studio, the immortal Neil Payne. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Chad.
Neil, it's just the two of us today.
I know.
Kate is on that book leave we talked about last week.
Yeah.
How many words through the 15,000 do you think she's gotten so far?
Oh, man. That is a great question.
I saw her on TV last week suggesting that not a ton of the 15,000 had elapsed.
So how much time did she have?
I think it was two or three
budgeted?
Weeks.
Oh, my God. Kate, please, if you're listening to this, please write.
Spend a few of those 15,000
words. Don't actually listen to Hot Takedown,
yeah.
I guess.
Right, yeah. In the next half hour, Kate, you could have written 1,000 words.
Yeah.
But instead, you're listening to us.
You write 1,000 words in a half hour? Wow, Chad.
Neil, you know, you don't become an editor
yeah,
by writing
right.
slowly. All right, on today's show...
you do become an editor by writing slowly.
Ooh, that's harsh, Neil. On today's show, we will discuss whether the Golden State Warriors just won the 2017 NBA title by signing Kevin Durant. We will also discuss the chances they can win that title without losing a game in the regular season, that 82-0 season. Neil,
is that something people are actually talking about?
Last week, remember I said that there was an ESPN hotline before Durant
signed
with the Warriors. Can the Warriors go 82-0 with Durant next season?
Wow.
So get ready. And what the Thunder will look like without Durant. We'll also talk about that. And then we will drift towards Europe, where they are still playing soccer. We'll break down the Euro quarterfinals and talk with Mike Cayley of the Double Pivot podcast about what's to come. Will Ronaldo show up to play? Then, after a quick ride through the channel, we will visit Wimbledon to talk Venus Williams's resurgence, Novak Djokovic's flameout, and whether Sam Querrey is the future of American tennis. Neil, are you ready to be the future of this podcast?
Oh, I'm the future, the past, and the present.
All right, so let's go to the NBA. How do you follow up a 73-9 season that collapsed on the doorstep of history? You sign a historically great power forward. The Warriors got the prize at free agency when they snared Kevin Durant on Monday. Durant, of course, is very good, but he also transforms the Warriors, a team that had already transformed the NBA. As Josh Levine at Slate put it, if Curry, Clay, Iggy, Barnes, Draymond was the death lineup, then Curry, Clay, Iggy, Durant, Draymond is the Earth extinction event.
Mm-hmm.
Neil, just how good is this lineup?
Pretty good. So we crunched the numbers on the Warriors and looked at their plus-minus projections for the following season. So in this case, 2017, with Kevin Durant in the lineup. And really surrounded, they only have like a handful of players, you know, the players that you've come to know and love very well over the past few seasons, like Klay Thompson and Steph Curry and, you know, Andre Iguodala. Guys like that under contract, and really once you get past that core group, they don't really have anyone actually kind of on the roster that they can really, you know, keep and stay under the cap going forward. So they would have to, I think they have like a little bit over $1 million of cap space left with which they need to get like, you know, more than a handful of players going forward.
I'll do it
and
for
they
free.
Can right, Chad. You'll check the phone and
you have not
you know,
seen my suite. Sweet drive through the lane.
I mean, you're probably as good as Dellavedova as it is. But, yeah, so, you know, they can pay minimum salary contracts and, you know, do some things to fill out the roster. But to be honest, a lot of those players on a normal team would be replacement-level players. So when we made our assumption and kind of filled out their roster with replacement-level players, we found that they – would have somewhere between 65 to 70 win true talent. That is, Kevin Durant and Steph Curry and the core, plus just all scrubs, like nothing but D-League caliber scrubs.
And how many scrubs? So it's the top five starters that I just mentioned, plus
right.
Who else is left beyond that we already know and love? Not
pretty
many
much
people.
No
one. Okay.
Yeah.
And so, and there's still a 65 to 70 win team with scrubs. But it might just be scrubs in reality that are filling out that roster.
Yeah, well, the history of teams like this, if you look back at, say, the Heat after LeBron joined them, or the Cavs after LeBron joined them, or even some of those Lakers teams.
All those LeBron teams.
Right, a lot of LeBron teams have followed this template they set the template that Kevin Durant has followed. Those teams were able to lure players that were sort of veteran types that
like
were
Miller,
willing.
Birdman, that
absolutely.
Kind of
those were players that were probably better than replacement level players, but were able to be signed on the cheap because it's just such an attractive destination if all you want to do is win a ring before you retire. And so I wouldn't be surprised if the Warriors are able to do the same thing. And if they are, we found that, you know, there's this massive kind of unallocated minutes on their depth chart right now that we don't know who they're necessarily going to go to. Only 17% of those need to go to average players or come out average as opposed to replacement level. In order for this to be the most talented team on paper, according to preseason projections of all time. Now, the previous
So, can we slow down there for a second? You said 70% of the minutes go to an average player.
Right.
Suggesting basically they just need one average
Pretty
player.
Pretty much one
right?
average
Given
player.
Given that one out of five
right,
and all
exactly.
that good jazz. So that's within reach, right?
No, completely.
They get an average player,
whether the
player's average at the beginning of the season or just stumbles in and happens to play it at an average
player. Sure, exactly. Yeah, and that's a great point that these are the types of players that you can kind of sign, you know, if they're kind of waiting around to see how things shake out during the season even. And if it seems almost more likely than not to me that they will kind of surpass the 2010/11 Heat, which was the previous team that kind of had the best preseason projected talent level of any team ever. But I think basketball fan listeners will kind of note that 2011 Heat team didn't win the championship, and in fact they struggled relative to expectations, at least for most of that season.
That was the whole, is LeBron a winner or not, and all that.
Right, exactly. And that 2010 summer in which LeBron joined the Heat and Chris Bosh joined the Heat and they formed that big three with Dwayne Wade, that was one of the first times that we'd ever seen perhaps the first time that we'd ever seen three of these kind of future Hall of Fame type players in their primes join forces. There have been other cases in which, and you can debate whether Chris Bosh is a Hall of Famer or not. I mean, I think he's kind of borderline.
But this might be four.
Right, exactly.
And depending on how you feel about Draymond Green.
Right. I mean, I think that this is kind of underscores how unique and rare this is, because we had seen cases where the Lakers got Wilt Chamberlain, but Elgin Baylor and Jerry West were already pretty old by that point. The Celtics in 2008, they had Kevin Garnett, who was past his prime, but still great, joining forces with Ray Allen and Paul Pierce, who are also kind of similarly into their 30s. These guys are all still really young and in their 20s and still at the height of their basketball power. So it's going to be a fascinating experiment of basketball.
So you mentioned 65 to 70 win team. Just to put this to rest, there is no universe of an undefeated Warriors team, despite how good they are, right? And we talked about this over and over again.
I wouldn't say no universe, but it's pretty unlikely. Right, exactly. I mean, if you think about it, they're probably not going to win 73 games again, even though they're probably more talented than they were when they won 73 games, which sounds backwards and weird, and how can that be possible? You take this record-breaking team, add, you know, one of the five best players in the NBA to that, how does that not add up to more wins? But I think it kind of talks about the way in which you have to be really good and also really lucky and kind of have everything come together for you to break one of these win records in a season. And we even saw that with the Warriors. They just barely hung on at the end of the season after losing a couple games in the last couple weeks of the season.
And there were a number of overtime games, including teams like the
if
Nets.
If any of those games go differently, and to be fair, they had other games that kind of went poorly in those ways, but I think the ones that went well for them in kind of a coin flip flip type situation outnumbered the ones that went poorly. And so if any of those go differently, then we're not talking about them as having the all-time win record. And so that sort of underscores the challenge that will face this team, even before we get into the questions of how will Durant fit in this situation with a bunch of, you know, other scorers.
I was about to ask you about fit. So we saw in Cleveland, for example, Kevin Love, they still haven't quite figured out how that fit is going to work, it seems, in Cleveland, especially in the playoffs. We saw Love ride the bench for large stretches of time. And I wonder if that applies to Durant, but at the same time, between Durant and Curry, you now have the scoring leaders from 2010, 2011, 2012, 2014, and 2016 on the same team.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if that's too irresistible to pass up, or if that actually suggests there may be a diminishing return, basically, about how much scoring there is to go around. During stat schools, we always talk about how basketball is all about how possessions end.
Mm-hmm.
And someone's got to take the shot. And now, are there too many people who are too good to take the shot?
Usage rate, Chad.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that was one of the things that we kind of found when we were digging into the history of these other teams that were projected to be really good, these super teams that took different superstars and mashed them together on one roster, is they almost never meet expectations. If you just kind of took the stats and naively said, oh, well, you know, all of these players are going to work together at their established, you know, level of production in the past, even in a statistic that isn't like kind of an aggregate stat, but something that's more like a plus minus stat that tries to capture your individual impact. If you look at all of these teams, I think the 08 Celtics were one of the few exceptions to this, and they were kind of a perfect case of fit working for the team. These teams tend to underperform relative to expectations almost as a rule, badly underperform, where, you know, if you looked at the stats for the 2011 Heat, you would have expected 70 wins at kind of like as a mean projection, and they only ended up winning in the 60s, I think, or maybe even high 50s that year. So one thing that I tried to look at when I was writing my story today was trying to figure out, well, is there a pattern to the type of roster construction such that we even have like a sample to go on of teams that resist the pull of this diminishing returns more than others? And one thing that I found was a very slight effect in all of these cases, but teams that their players, even after you kind of control for the talent level, because the more the talent level in general, the more the diminishing returns. And that's kind of an unescapable fact.
Because the better you are, the higher you're supposed to be, and therefore...
Right, and also the more kind of you'll have to give up, because these players that have the really high, you know, plus-minus ratings tend to be players that do everything for their teams. And so it's almost like it's physically impossible for you to have the same type of impact when playing alongside another really great player. But going back to it, even after controlling for that, the teams that tended to underperform more than we would expect just from their talent level were teams that had too much scoring, too much usage rate, like you mentioned before, Chad, and too much rebounding.
You have too much usage rate? Isn't usage rate 100% for the team regardless?
Well, if you look at the previous year for the players, for instance, adding a Bosch and a Wade, and you get over 100%,
right.
And that's kind of where those teams kind of got into trouble, I think, and one of the contributing factors to their underperformance. However, you can seem to be able to offset it, not to the point where you actually kind of overcome the diminishing returns completely, but you can mitigate those diminishing returns if you have a team that is good at shooting, a team that has a lot of playmakers on it, and a team that's good at defense, especially on defense, because if you think about it, there is no real diminishing returns effect on defense, at least within reason, if you, keeping offense constant, obviously there's a lot of trade-off. Yeah, exactly. You know, the more great defenders that you put together, you can almost amplify it and make a better defense. And then the other two, it's been known to basketball stat heads for a long time that, you know, passers and shooters, floor spacers, are the types of offensive players that kind of make their teammates better, even, you know, independent of their own stats. They give their teammates more room to operate and make them, you know, be able to play better. So in the Warriors' case, with Durant in the mix, they're going to have these scores. They have three of the top 30 usage rate and two of the top 10 players from last year. That is going to work, you know, against them and kind of contribute to underperformance. But They also have an ungodly shooting lineup now with Durant. They may be able to resist the pull of diminishing returns more than we would expect.
So let's move to the Thunder now. And what does this what is this team going forward? Is this what is interesting to me about this free agent signing is it provides, in some ways, two natural experiments for stat head types. One is the one you just spoke about, which is what happens when you put this many good players on a team in Golden State. And then the other is what happens when you give a team to Russell Westbrook. And presumably, I mean, Westbrook might take, what, 35, 40 shots a night on that Thunder team?
I mean, he was already challenging the single season usage rate record on a team that had Kevin Durant on it, at least some of the time, not last season, but the season before. So to think about him without that kind of counterbalance.
So have you run the numbers with Carmelo or anything like that on the Thunder about projected record?
No, we haven't done anything on the Thunder, but we did a little bit of that in speculating what would happen to them and kind of looked at their rating compared to, you know, previous versions of themselves, and we found that if they had retained Durant, they would have had the best rating in team history after
Oladipo
they picked up Victor Oladipo. However, the idea of losing Durant even after getting Oladipo would just relegate them to kind of a middle of the pack, but, you know, still a playoff team probably in the West even, but, you know, probably no better than a Portland Trailblazers or someone like that, in which case, you know, it does signal, first of all, the end of this Thunder era as we knew it, and also, you know, Russell Westbrook is going to be a free agent pretty soon. And so the question becomes, you know, do they blow up the whole thing and kind of send him elsewhere? And that would be another superstar, another one of these top five players that would be able to make their mark in a different city.
By trade, the Thunder
by free agency down the road, you know, depending on how it works out for them. But I think we're seeing like kind of an unprecedented flow of these top players kind of go from, you know, different cities to other ones. And
the salary cap has a lot to do with that because of the way that these contracts have
specifically
been...
the max salary rule.
Exactly. I don't want to get into that because that's better left
it
for
really
a sports economist.
It really is a terrible rule, though. We should talk about it at some point because this effect that we're seeing right now, you know, Kevin Durant going to a team that's already stacked with superstars is almost a direct consequence, an unintended consequence of capping the maximum salary that a player can make, because then you start looking at non-monetary considerations as being the, you know, motivating factor for your free agency decisions. And so, of course, eventually some superstar was going to end up going to a team just strictly to try to win a ring, because it seems like, you know, if another team isn't going to be able to pay you substantially more, why not? Especially with the narrative that we have that rings are all that matter when assessing a player's legacy. Kevin Durant acted in kind of a perfectly rational way, even though a lot of people are kind of criticizing him for it.
To save that idea for 1 second.
Right.
And let's listen to this take from Stephen A. Smith.
Oh, boy.
Well, I'm viewing it as the weakest move I've ever seen from a superstar. Plain and simple. That's just how I look at it. You depart for the team that beat you when you're on the cusp of getting to the finals yourself or ultimately winning the championship for the franchise that you've been with since you've come into the NBA. I think it's incredibly weak. What it comes down to is that Kevin Durant is one of the top three players in the world, and he ran away from the challenge that he faces in order to jump on a bandwagon of a team that's a little bit better, that's already rife with at least one superstar, a couple of guys that can really, really get it done. I just view it as him jumping on a bandwagon, and I think it's the weakest move I've ever seen by a superstar, plain and simple.
So we can't quite bring numbers to such a normative judgment.
It's a hot take.
That's quite the hot take from Stephen A. Smith. Now, but Neil, talk to me about rational decision-making within the NBA given the salary cap.
Yeah, I mean, this is the same exact argument that a lot of people made after LeBron went to the Heat in 2010 with the decision and all that. And I think, you know, people that are criticizing it aren't necessarily thinking about the incentives that the league has set up. And I think it's unintentionally set up because they've had the max salary rule going back to, I think, Jordan in the mid to late 90s. But when you cap the salary of how much one player can make in a sport where one player has so much value and could be making something on the order of 2 to 3 times what that max salary is, you have deliberately set up a system in which, first of all, and we may have talked talked about this last week as well. The top players are almost subsidizing. I was stunned over the last week at this like wave of kind of alerts I get on my phone when, you know, news happenings take place in the NBA and free agent signings, of these almost like outright scrubs that were getting, you know, $10 or more million a year contracts. And that is a direct result of, we've talked about the salary cap increasing so much from last year to this year, but also the fact that you can't pay a Kevin Durant what he's actually worth in terms of, you know, the product that he actually brings to a team, then you have to end up diverting that money to far lesser players. And then it also kind of sets up the situation that we just talked about, where if you're Kevin Durant, and you know that people are going to judge your legacy on championships, and they're not going to really ultimately care how you got those championships. And I think LeBron proved that to a certain extent. LeBron ended up being the best player on those Heat teams. You know, as much as we thought Wade's going to take the last shot, Wade's going to win Finals MVP, they're going to be devalued rings, I think Durant is, you know, going to be the best player, you know, or co-best player with Steph Curry on the Warriors, and we're not going to care if they win a championship together when all is said and done. You know, that's the whole reason that they play the game, is to win. The enjoyment and the feeling of winning, you know, that becomes the main consideration. So I'm kind of going off on my own hot take here, but I think, you know, it's a perfectly rational consequence of the economic system that the NBA has set up. And if they people want that to change, then they need to change the incentives.
Neil, what if we just had a spinoff Hot Takedown podcast called Change the Incentives, in which you ranted about the perverse incentives right
of just
sports
in general? Yeah,
I'd listen. Okay, let's leave it there and move on to our sponsor. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. This completely online process lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using your phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinancing in just a few minutes. Get a custom mortgage solution at your own pace, whenever and wherever you want. So if you're looking to refinance or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/takedown. Quicken Loans is an equal housing lender. It's licensed in all 50 states, and you can find details at nmlsconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. Once more, if you're looking to refinance or buy a home, check out quickenloans.com/takedown. The semifinals of the UEFA soccer tournament have arrived, and France, Germany, Portugal, and Wales are still standing. To help us understand what's to come and how these four made it past the quarterfinals, Michael Cayley has joined us. Hello, Michael.
Hey, y'all. How's it going?
We should note, Michael, that you do the Double Pivot podcast with our usual soccer talker, Mike Goodman. So, Michael, Mike Goodman, we've called our senior global soccer correspondent. Given that you are his podcast partner, you can have whatever inflated title you want. What is the inflated title you've always longed for in your soccer commentating analyst career?
All right. Well, let's say that I am the official stats analyst of this podcast, soccer stats analyst of this podcast, of Hot Takedown.
Okay, let's begin with Ronaldo, Cristiano Ronaldo versus Gareth Bale, otherwise referred to as Portugal versus Wales. So, Michael, is this match easily turned by one of those strikers showing up with a scintillating performance? Like, is it going to be as simple as whichever striker is better, or is this going to be something that where the full team really comes into play?
I think that for the most part through this Euros, Portugal has been extremely impressive, despite not getting that. They still haven't won a game in 90 minutes yet, but their underlying numbers are outshooting their opponents about 2-1. They've been very defensively sound. Both Croatia and Poland are very solid teams. They totally took them off their games. So I think that sort of as a tactical whole, Portugal should be solidly favored in this game. As you say, exactly, you know, when there's a player as good as Gareth Bale on one side for Wales, there's no question that Bale could have one of those big games. So far this tournament, though, Bale has often functioned as a decoy for Wales. He's been effectively marked by other teams that sort of keyed on him defensively. He's been involved in only about a third, under a third of the best chances that Wales created, while Ronaldo has been involved, that is, either took the shot or made the pass that assisted the shot, in about two-thirds of the best chances that Portugal has created. So for the most part, Bale has functioned somewhat more as a decoy and as a secondary player, has been more easily marked out of games than Ronaldo has been. Both have been, both are very dangerous players. It's only a small sample of games. But a lot of the indicators to me, I think Portugal should be solidly favored in this matchup, both sort of at the team level, and Ronaldo's been more dangerous over the tournament, really, despite scoring fewer goals.
Yeah, Michael, I'm pretty fascinated by Wales' rise to the semifinal because they are the team that seems kind of out of place, whether you look at like the world ranking or the ELO ratings or whatever, among these teams. Do you think that decoy strategy has been sort of the secret to their success in terms of sneaking up on people? Maybe they are keying on Gareth Bale and losing sight of the other players on his team? Or what accounts for them kind of making this leap into this stratosphere of Euro?
So one thing that's going on with Wales is, and sort of the story of their sort of rise, their unexpected rise, they did quite well in their qualifying. They qualified automatically in second place in their group behind Belgium. And they've developed in a sort of relatively quick span of time a set of, not just Gareth Bale, who's an elite superstar, but a set of solid, like, Premier League, top league quality players. Aaron Ramsey, who's supporting him, Joe Allen in central midfield, Ashley Williams in center back. These are good players. And so I think one thing that's happened is that a lot of things sort of talent clicked into place for Wales at key central positions at the right time. So I think Wales are somewhat better than some of their rankings would suggest because this all sort of just happened recently. The other thing I'd say with Wales is what they've done is they've done just enough. They've done just enough to win. They got a group where England was a little bit disappointing and Russia was extremely disappointing. They got a somewhat fortunate win against Slovakia, and then they won the Russia game they had to. They won their group. They got a very easy draw. One of the stories of this tournament has been the two sides of the knockout groups are totally huge gap in quality. You can see that in the semifinals right now. You've got France and Germany coming in, and those teams having knocked out, Italy, Spain, etc. Whereas on the other side, you've got Wales, who had to beat Northern Ireland, and then their last match was a very impressive victory over Belgium. So they've done enough to get by, but they haven't had nearly as tough a path as some other teams.
So let's move on from the Portugal and Wales match up to the other semifinal between France and Germany. And for those like me, Michael, who mostly watch international soccer during World Cup years, I've been surprised that France is the favorite. Obviously, they're playing at home, but it does seem like something has changed maybe with the German team that I watched in Brazil be so good 2 years ago. Am I missing something? Because France is favored according to ESPN soccer model.
Yeah, so I mean, it's definitely sort of it's a close match either way. One of the things that's going on for Germany is that they've had some key injuries and some key suspensions at the wrong time. Sami Khedira, who they very much depend on as their sort of defensive anchor in midfield, he got hurt. Bastian Schweinsteiger, who replaced him, also got hurt. Mats Hummels is a key center back and also sort of a key sort of in early starting attacks from as a passer out of center back is on a yellow card suspension. So it's not quite and their striker, Mario Gomez, is out. So a bunch of players got hurt at the very wrong time right before this semifinal. The other thing is that France has developed a lot of talent in a short span of time. One thing that's happened for France is the development of guys like Dimitri Payet, who was a relatively he's good in Ligue 1, but he suddenly had this huge breakout year for West Ham, and is now he's one of their two key playmakers along with Paul Pogba. N'Golo Kanté, who was not anywhere near the France side, is a good chance he's going to start. He was the midfield key to Leicester winning the title this year. So France have also developed a bunch of talent and haven't been struck by sort of bad luck with injuries and cards and suspensions in the way that Germany has.
They're also the host country. Do we know statistically what kind of bump that usually gives countries in major tournaments?
Yeah, it's big. And I mean, this is the thing with home field advantage is that the numbers I have are that typical home field advantage in terms of goals scored is about a 10% advantage in major league matches in soccer, and it tends to run 15 to 20% advantage in international matches. So expect a somewhat larger home field advantage in international matches.
Okay, so let's also talk about sort of the trends that we're seeing in this European tournament. It seems to me like this is maybe this is my naive American view, but that sort of what that soccer does have fads of play that sweep through, and a lot of it can come in these tournaments where the best players are all in one place. Is there anything that we're seeing now that's really going to show up in the English Premier League or in La Liga or anywhere else going forward?
Well, I'd say that one. So I sort of have two answers to that. One of them is a trend that I think isn't necessarily something we're going to see in the other leagues, but it is an interesting thing to watch, which is one of the big stories of this tournament, I think, has been teams that have quality tactical coaching and that have players that work together in coherent tactical systems have been consistently able to punch way above their weight in a kind of fun way. Italy has a team. Italy, you know, traditional superpower, is in a real trough of talent. They're breaking out a team with mostly sort of guys who are in the mid-table in the Premier League or in the Serie A. But they were able to beat Belgium. They were able to beat Spain by having a really good tactical plan that sort of countered what those teams did well. Wales beating Belgium was very much about Belgium not having a coherent tactical plan, leaving way too much space open for players like Gareth Bale to counterattack in, and Wales were set up to exploit that. And I think next year in the Premier League we're going to see a huge number of really elite tactical managers doing their thing. With Mourinho's back, Pep Guardiola is managing for Manchester City. They still got Klopp at Liverpool. Antonio Conte, who is the manager of this Italian team that punched so far above their weight, is going to be managing Chelsea. So I think we're sort of seeing there's a real tactical story going on.
Now, I think for a lot of people, the legacy of this tournament or the lasting memory will be the run that Iceland went on. What did you make of all that? And is that just kind of a blip on the radar in which like a just tiny, country team just sort of pulls off upsets and there's nothing to make of it? Or did they do something tactically interesting that might carry over going forward?
Yeah, I mean, Iceland were not like, what Iceland were, which I think is really interesting, is people make a lot of jokes, and I was making a lot of jokes about all of the stuff about Iceland's population. But a country of 300,000 developing as much soccer talent as they did to put together a reasonably coherent international soccer team is really interesting. And there have been a bunch of stories about sort of the Icelandic development model and the way the country just sort of plowed lots of money into getting opportunities for kids to play soccer. And so everyone could play, and everyone could get reasonably good coaching. The other thing I think that is sort of fun with Iceland is that lots of teams that manage to punch above their weight for a while tend to do so very defensively. They tend to do so by just sitting back and being organized and being kind of boring. And Iceland weren't like that. Iceland were a counterattacking team rather than a purely defensive team. I think that's one of the reasons sort of people fell in love with watching them, is they were adventurous. They were sending lots of players forward. So I don't know, I don't think there's too much tactically to be drawn from Iceland, but I think the story of Icelandic development is interesting, and they sure were fun.
They sure were. All right, Michael Caley, one of the hosts of the Double Pivot podcast. Thanks for coming on Hot Takedown.
Thanks for having me. It was a great time.
Okay, before we move on to tennis, let's do a rare breaking news.
I know, we need
cut
to break
in
with that ABC News breaking theme.
To Hot Takedown. So earlier, when we were talking about Kevin Durant and the Warriors, we mentioned that if the Warriors had even one average player, that their projected win total would, what was it, Neil, go above 70, was it?
Well, that they would be the most talented team ever.
And sure enough,
literally while taping,
the Warriors reportedly have agreed to terms with David West for the league minimum, therefore keeping it beneath that that very tight cap that they have left, that money that they have left over. And Neil, is David West the average player you were looking for?
He's actually much better than average player, especially on defense.
The Warriors are the best ever.
Getting richer. They're number one. Pop the cork. Give them the pre-championship.
Excellent. All right. Now, actually, on to tennis. where, as always, Carl Bialik is with us. Carl, welcome back to Hot Takedown.
Hello, Chad.
Carl, 538 writer, of course. Now, Carl, Venus Williams is still in this tournament. She has reached the semifinals along with Serena Williams. Her tournament so far has been pretty good. The last two matches, she's won in two sets, not three. Straight sets, one might call it, in the tennis world. had a close call against in the third round when she won the third set 10-8. But otherwise has looked strong throughout from my novice eyes. Is that a fair characterization?
Absolutely. It was really vintage Venus today. She was slicing her way to the net, putting away volleys, serving big. It, you know, made you think maybe we were 10 years earlier in the tennis history.
So is this a common thing? I know you've looked at historical sort of ups and downs of various tennis players. I don't know if you have those numbers on hand for Venus, but it strikes me that we talked about Venus every now and then as sort of coming back, sort of, but never quite in such good form and maybe this deep into a tournament.
What she's doing is hard to really measure because there just haven't been that many players as good as her. I think the closest analog is Martina Navratilova had a bit of a bump late in her career after reaching 35. A lot of the top women weren't even playing at Venus's age. She's just turned 36 last month. Her sister, Serena, who we've talked about in this podcast many times, had kind of a bump in her early 30s. But as she approaches the late 30s, she may be declining a little bit herself. So Venus might be in uncharted territory, especially if she wins a couple more matches and wins this tournament.
It's an interesting question about whether every bump is the same, I guess, right? So like, so Serena had a bump but was already at a higher level than Venus's nadir was, right? In the sense that,
yeah.
So, you know, should we treat bumps from someone who wasn't good or who was mediocre, let's say, to being good as different than someone who was good to great to being super good?
Yeah, it's always harder to make that second leap. Then there are also always individual mitigating factors. Like both of them have had health problems. And in Venus's case, she has a fatigue syndrome called Sjogren's, which when she announced it, I think a lot of people thought, oh, this might be the beginning of the end. And there were times when it really looked like she had trouble playing through a long match. So winning that match, like you mentioned, 10-8, at the age of 36, even without that health problem, would be impressive. So, you know, even if it's not quite as impressive as what Serena's done, which is sort of what you could say about all of Venus's singles career, it's still really something to do what she's doing at 36.
Yeah. Are there any other cases of people who kind of dropped well outside the top 10? I'm looking at the ELO ratings right now, and right now she's ninth and could grow, you know, could go up even higher if she ends up winning, that, you know, seemed like they had kind of reached this point in their career in which their days as being a top 10 player were done and then kind of came back. Is Navratilova kind of the only person you can think of in that group?
Well, I'm really isolating to players who are among the all-time greats. I think there have been some individual cases. Schiavone was not as old as Venus when she won the French Open, but she kind of came out of nowhere. Like it wasn't even like she was coming back to a level where she was before. She'd never come close to winning a major. And you have cases like that here and there. But I think we're also in kind of a weird time in tennis, which we've talked about before in the podcast. It's true on the men's side, but also on the women's, that there's a generation of somewhat mediocrity. So Venus is doing well to be in the semi, but she also didn't have to face Muguruza, who just won the French Open but lost early at Wimbledon. She was someone who Venus should have faced. So she hasn't really been beating top players to get this far. She's just been benefiting from a weaker draw and playing well against the players she's faced.
So before we move on to the men's draw, what are the chances that we get a Williams on Williams final?
I'd put Serena at 70 or 80% in her semi. She's playing someone who she's never lost a set to, not even really come close to.
And unranked.
And unseeded.
Unseeded, excuse me.
And Venus is playing Kerber, who's probably the favorite in that match. She won the Australian Open earlier this year. But this is her favorite tournament. This is her best surface. She's really great attacking on grass. So I don't know, maybe overall like 30, 40%, which is probably a whole lot higher than people thought before this tournament was the chance of ever seeing them in a Grand Slam final again.
Okay, let's move on to Novak Djokovic, who was defeated by an American, which we'll get to in a second, in the third round in four sets. It was a delayed match, right? There was the rain, I think it was like four rain delays or something like that, and they suspended it and waited until the next day.
Right.
Should that color how we think of this upset, or was something off with Djokovic?
That's a tricky question. I think it colors in the sense that Djokovic has had trouble before in situations like this, sometimes not in that match, but then in the next match. He is great about certain kinds of adversity on the court, but also sometimes can be distracted by a bad call or by someone in the stands making noise, or just, you know, perceived injustice. And this was a really interesting quirk of Wimbledon here. So there's one court at Wimbledon that has a roof, center court. Djokovic has won the last four Grand Slams, is by far the number one player in the world, yet he wasn't playing on center court. So if he had been, there would have been no rain delays or just a brief one while they closed the roof. But it turns out that some guy you've never heard of named Dan Evans, who's British, happened to make the third round against Federer. And if Evans had lost, there would have been a reasonable case for putting Djokovic on center. But with a Brit against Federer, Djokovic didn't have a chance, and that threw things off. But you could also say, here's a guy, Querrey, who never had a win anywhere close to this, who had to wait 24 hours to try to close it out. And he came out looking pretty tight, and Djokovic looked like he was benefiting, not Querrey, from the delay. I mean, Querrey was kind of killing him before the delay. So I think Djokovic himself said, and others would say, you can't really blame it on the delay, but it is funny how just a little twist like that can potentially have a big effect.
Where does that rank among like the upsets in recent years that we've seen? Or was it like a monumental upset or just kind of a run-of-the-mill upset that you see every few slams?
It was monumental, especially recently. So first of all, just Djokovic losing any time, but especially at a slam, is monumental. He'd won the last four slams. He'd won the last 30 matches he played at Grand Slams. And all of his rivals, by which I'm referring to Federer, Nadal, Murray, they just haven't had very many losses like this, especially when they were number one in the world. Back in the day, like Sampras and Agassi, who we think of mostly for their great titles, they had losses like this fairly often, relatively speaking. So it wasn't that strange. I mean, Sampras had some early losses even at Wimbledon where he was otherwise pretty dominant. But this felt really weird also because Querrey kind of has this reputation as a guy who has some great talent, but never seems that fired up or that likely to pull off an upset like this.
And it's funny that you mentioned Agassi and Sampras, because I think one time when you came on the podcast and we talked about the historical greats according to ELO ratings, their ratings were not really as high as the guys that we talk about now, Federer and Djokovic and whatnot. Do you think that kind of has something to do with it, the fact that these guys now just don't ever lose to this, you know, type caliber of opponent, or maybe also speaks to what you talked about earlier of there being this kind of void of challengers coming up from the younger ranks?
Yeah, I think it's both those things. I mean, ELO is calculated somewhat from when you have a bad loss. So sort of by definition, if Djokovic and company don't have very many of those, they're not going to often be losing a lot of ELO points. But I think it does speak to Sampras and Agassi's inconsistency. And if you read Agassi's book, you know, he talks about kind of the backstory of why he was inconsistent and what he was struggling with. And the top guys now all seem to kind of have squared away anything that could make them, you know, sort of struggle unexpectedly. Nadal has had injury problems, Federer at times too, but sort of anything in their personal life or any demons they seem to have conquered in a way that some previous champions didn't always succeed at doing.
Okay, so let's talk about Querrey real quick before we wrap this. It seems, is he the great American hope now? I feel like every Grand Slam, there's somebody who comes up and takes that mantle, however briefly. Were we expecting Querrey to be this sort of force for a long time? And finally, you know, his talent has manifested. He's still in the quarterfinals, and we don't know what's going to happen long term, obviously. Or is this all just biding time for that great wave of juniors that we know is coming?
Yeah, I think it's probably more the latter. I mean, the guy is almost 29. He's basically the same age as Djokovic and Murray. We know what those two have done, and this is Querrey's first Grand Slam quarterfinal. It is a pretty great accomplishment for him personally relative to what he's done, what his sort of peers in the American men group, what they've done, because he, you know, no one had made a quarterfinal at a slam from among the American men in 5 years. And I don't think Querrey was the most likely one to do it. John Isner had made a bunch of fourth rounds during that time. He kept falling short. So it's a great personal accomplishment for him. I think 20, 30 years ago, he would have been like the 8th or 10th ranked American. This would have been a cool achievement. And then he would have faced another American in the quarter, and probably the winner would face another American in the semi. Now he's kind of got the burden of he's the last American standing who has a chance to win this tournament. But I think it's really going to be that next generation, the guys like Taylor Fritz, who are going to have a chance to break through to a semi or a final.
Okay. Carl Bialik, as always, thanks for coming on. We'll talk to you if something major happens in the finals.
Major things happen at majors. So here's hoping. Thanks for having
me. Thanks, Carl. Okay, now that time of the show where someone brings a significant digit, a telling number from the world of sports. before we get to who that mystery person might be, let's listen to a clip.
20 seconds to go. Chestnut well over Stoney. Stoney's not in the game. It's all about Chestnut. It's all about the mustard belt, and it's all about the record now. 10 seconds to go. He's got to get that one down. There we go with 69. Final seconds. He got it. And he got 70.
The most
he
hot dogs,
70.
The most hot dogs ever eaten on the corner of Surf and Stillwell Avenues by the greatest eater in the history of mankind.
Neil, how many hot dogs have you eaten in, what is it, 15 minutes?
No, it's 10.
10 minutes? What do you think you could wolf down?
How many do I think I could have I? I think I have probably eaten four.
Four in 10 minutes.
In 10 minutes. I probably could hit double digits if I wanted to.
Did you soak the buns?
No, I didn't soak the buns.
I mean, come on.
And I didn't split the dog either. Please. So, there's upgrades.
The arbitrage available
there's
to you is
upgrades that can be done to my technique.
All right, Neil, you have brought us a significant digit about competitive eating.
Yeah.
What do you have for us?
So our SIG dig this week is 215%, and that is the increase in the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest record from 20 years ago to today. The record 20 years ago was held by someone named Ed Krejci.
Eddie!
Who had 22 and a quarter dogs in 10 minutes, which is an oddly specific number of dogs. If you ever watch the contest and see these guys just stuffing these things in their mouth, how could you ever be that precise? Joey Chestnut yesterday on the 4th of July won the Nathan's contest this year. What they called the 100th contest, I think that might be perhaps dubious, I'm not sure, but he had 70. So that is a 215% increase in a 20-year span, and it's pretty remarkable if you look at the leaps and bounds by which the record for most hot dogs has jumped. For instance, in 2000, as recently as 2000, the record was still 25 1/8.
It's a pre-Kobayashi PK.
Right. So Takeru Kobayashi is the kind of key figure that presages this enormous leap. He's like almost the Babe Ruth of in fact, as I'll note later in the SIG dig, he's better than Babe Ruth. So he increased the record from 25 1/8 to 50. That is more than a 100% increase in 1 year in 2001. Babe Ruth.
Can I just check your stats there for a second?
Yeah.
25 1/8 to 50 is more than 100% increase.
Well, it's less than
100%. Is it not, stat man? You are caught out in a statistical lie.
It's less.
Lie,
it's slightly less
Neil.
Than 100%.
All right. Carry
slightly
on.
Less than
Carry
100%.
Carry on. You know,
sorry,
someone's
got
to fact
check
me.
Look, I got my Excel sheet numbers mixed up.
All right.
So Babe Ruth actually increased the record for home runs in a single season when he hit 54. He beat Ned Williamson's record by 100%. Nettie. That was what I was looking at. He doubled Ned Williamson's record of 27. Wayne Gretzky, when he had 212 points in a season, beat Dickie Moore's existing record of 96 points by 121%. Dan Marino, when he had set the record for most touchdown passes with 48, only beat Y.A. Tittle's record of 36 by 33%. So Kobayashi and now Joey Chestnut, if you look at his record, 70 is a huge increase even over the 50s that Kobayashi was putting up. People are eating at a far increased pace than they used to. And I want to take a quote from my colleague Walt Hickey's column. He wrote a story about competitive eating last week in advance of the contest. And he talked to a guy who was a spokesperson for the Nathan's contest. And this quote is, quote, "History makes a mockery of those who doubt the human spirit. We've known this for a long, long time, whether it's sports, arts, culture, or science. In terms of the ceiling, I don't know if there is a ceiling."
Well,
so that just
you know,
tells
this is before Moneyball even comes to competitive eating.
Well, I think it did, though. Kobayashi was someone who you talked about soaking the HDB, mm-hmm. Soaking the bun to maximize your HDBs.
Did you just say HDB?
Right, exactly. And breaking the dog, that was something that people hadn't done. And I think you can attribute the quantum leap forward before him to this era that we're in right now to this dramatic change in technique. Someone compared it in Walt's article to the Fosbury flop, the high jump technique that really revolutionized high jumping. I think competitive eating also has these moments of just genius that take it to another level that we haven't seen before.
Okay, listeners, you can read more about Major League Eating and the moneyballing therein at 538. Walt Hickey's article can be found on Hot Takedown's article page as well. Neil, excellent.
Sure.
Thanks very much. All right. That, Neil, will do it for this week's show. Neil, do you think we did right by Kate? Do we think we kept her her memory and you know?
I think so.
Alive?
Although I'm curious as to what her HDB count would be if she competed.
All right, thanks, Neil, for chatting. As thanks, always, Chad. Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast Kobayashi is Jody Avergan. We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Jonathan Yales. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. Find us on Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps, your favorite included. We're on iTunes, of course, as well. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. While you're there, review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Of course, also discover 538's other podcasts. What's the Point is out there waiting for you. 538 Elections is out there waiting for you. And of course, Neil, one other sneaky shadow podcast.
Shadow Pod.
The one and only Panic City. The only Mets podcast devoted to Mets emotions. Mets fans' emotions is out there waiting for you. That's Neil and I talking about the Mets. Subscribe to that as well. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.